Welcome to the More Perfect Union, the podcast that offers real debate without the hate. From the right tonight, we have...
DJ McGuire, a progressive conservative from Suffolk, Virginia.
And from the left, we have...
Greg Matuszak, a common sense liberal from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Rebecca Kushmider, a progressive feminist from Kensington, Maryland.
And I'm Kevin Kelton, a passionate moderate from Los Angeles, California. And tonight I want to mention, before we get going on the events of the week past, I want to mention that on our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, we also have political commentary that we all write at various times during the week. And this past week we added a couple of columns, including one from Rebecca in her ongoing Pop Goes the Pop Culture series of articles, and one from DJ McGuire about the Australian diplomat story in the news. First, I wanted to start with Rebecca. Rebecca, what topics did you touch on in that one?
Oh, I touched on a fabulous story in which Keith Richards got angry when Donald Trump gave himself top billing over the Rolling Stones. And I talk about charities that Harry and Meghan chose for their guests to contribute to in lieu of gifts at the royal wedding. And other stuff that I can't recall because I wrote it on Friday and now it's Monday.
But it's a real fun read. Rebecca goes into the stuff that we don't have time to get to in this show because we're so news heavy, but it's a lot of fun. And DJ, you did go into the news with your story. You want to give us a TV guide, you know, onesie on what it's
sure.
about?
Sure. The name of the Australian diplomat who really started the whole investigation into Russia and the Trump campaign has been known for a few months, but it only became something I knew about this week. And when I saw the name, I realized that this was someone far more important in Australia than your average diplomat. And for that reason, as I discuss in the column, it gives the investigation a lot more credibility.
That was a really interesting column, DJ. I was looking at it earlier today. And that filled in a lot of blanks for me.
Just to be clear, this was the diplomat who was in the bar with Papadopoulos, right?
That's
I love this story. Just happened to be listening while Papadopoulos was bragging. Awesome.
Yeah. Papadopoulos, man. That's the guy. That's the guy you want to hire.
they're all guys you want to hire.
To get your coffee. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but we're going to start with a real happy story this week, which was the royal wedding. Now, I have to confess, I didn't get up at 4 a.m. on the West Coast to watch it. And I didn't watch any of the replays, but I know others here did. So let's start with you, Rebecca. What were your highlights and takeaways?
My highlights were the fact that it was this very royal wedding and that there were vintage Rolls Royces and people in beautiful hats. And then Meghan had put her stamp on it. She brought in this preacher, this bishop in the American Episcopal Church who was African-American, and he just gave the most wonderful colloquial, really rhythmic and beautiful sermon about the power of love and the power of faith. And then she had a gospel choir singing a really great arrangement of Stand By Me. And you see these British people with brooms up their butts who don't know quite what to do with American worship in this very, very gospel style. And I just loved seeing that. And I loved how she sat there smiling serenely the whole time because she knew what she was doing. She was shaking it up.
Yeah, it was a nice melding, let's say, of that. But I think before we move on to the actual coverage, I think we should mention that last week there was a mistake in our coverage, and one of our international fact checkers caught it, luckily.
Was it Basil or Dimitri? Who caught that?
Yes, yes. We have a team, of international fact checkers.
All over the world fact-checking us.
Who was quick to notice that Meghan Merkel is not Canadian. And I know we said that on our show, but
I thought she was Canadian. I got confused. She's actually from Los Angeles. I'm sorry, Meghan.
But luckily,
aren't all Canadians from Los Angeles?
Pretty much. They go there at least once. but I thought it was great. you know, I like a royal wedding as much as the next guy from the Midwest, and it was it, and you're right, the sermon was wonderful. We all were expecting like an old guy with white hair to go, marriage, love, true love,
but brings us together today. And actually, maybe all weddings should include a little bit of that.
DJ, you're the Anglophile here. What did you think?
I focused more attention on the coverage of the wedding than the wedding itself. The thing I found interesting in the examination, the coverage of the wedding, was one, the response within the black community in Britain. African British MP, David Lammy, referred to the wedding as Britain's Obama moment. And we laugh at this, but the fact that there is now someone of African descent in the royal family is really something that is a very big deal for them. And I don't think we should necessarily take it lightly. Although as Americans, I think it is
a triumph over colonialism. It took this long.
It says something about the ability of the British monarchy to adapt and why it is in fact still around when for so long it was perceived and could have been perceived as an ancient institution, an institution that time has passed by. It finds a way to stay modern. It finds a way to stay relevant. And this was just another example of that.
It was pretty. There were horses. There were flowers. It was pretty.
And I was just going to add, being this sentimentalist that I am, that she just made an unbelievably lovely bride.
Oh, she really did. She was beautiful.
That was my whole takeaway. Yeah.
She was beautiful.
And the dresses and the dress she wore to the gala afterwards, whatever they called it. That was all great. So we're sorry about the little mix-up about her being Canadian, which will give us a new title, you know, The More Perfect Union, Real Debate Without the Facts. So,
hey, our facts are still better than the administration's facts.
Wait, the administration has facts?
No, they don't, which brings us to the Russia investigation. And my gosh, we could fill the entire episode just talking about this. We have to start with what's going on with the embedded source who wasn't embedded and wasn't necessarily a source. And today, Trump used his willpower over the DOJ to start some kind of an internal investigation about that.
I have seen the name of the informant. I will not repeat it on this podcast.
Good for you.
Because it is wrong to do so. Yeah. Thank you.
Well said. Kudos.
He was not a spy in the campaign. He talked to three folks who were involved in the Trump campaign, and he informed the FBI the contents of those conversations, and he continued to get information from them. But he was never a part of the campaign directly, so that was just foolhardy. And really, all the DOJ did in response to Trump's tirade was say, you know what? We know you're examining how we conducted the Clinton investigation. Why don't you also take a look how we conducted the Trump administration to make sure we didn't do anything that was politically untoward or out of bounds?
Well, I saw Walter Schaub on Twitter this morning, and he was the former director of the Office of Government Ethics before he resigned due to the striking lack of ethics in government right now. And he was actually relieved to see that the DOJ was handing it off to the Inspector General because, as he said this morning, that puts it in the framework of a known process. This isn't the administration isn't really getting their way. They're it's being added to a list of other things that require investigation anyway.
So let me ask this question. Okay, we all agree that this was probably proper procedure. It doesn't seem like there was anything nefarious in it. And yet Rod Rosenstein capitulated to Trump's demand that there be an investigation of it, although he didn't create an FBI investigation or appoint a different special prosecutor. He simply rolled it into the DOJ's internal investigation mechanism. So my question is, did Rosenstein fold, or is he playing a brilliant poker hand that Trump isn't reading?
Yeah, I would call it a tactical retreat. A tactical retreat. It's where you where you realize that, okay, if you try to defend this hill, you will lose far too many people. So you engage tactical retreat to make sure your strategy doesn't come.
Yeah, but handing something over to an inspector general, that's
right.
it shuts Trump up. It doesn't create new structures. It doesn't hand things over to Devin Nunes yet. And it's like, okay, fine, little boy, I'll look under the bed for your monsters.
But at the same time, though, if he would have said, no, we're all above board, then that would have just raised more money for the Trump campaign and more, it would have just had this whole, like, oh, well, I am a victim. Obviously I'm a victim.
Well, because it would have fueled the whole deep state discussion. Right. Nobody wants
that. Deeper state. Come
on. Deeper state.
Let's speak.
Deeper state. Debbie does deep state.
Yeah.
By any chance, did anyone here read the Mark Penn op-ed or editorial, whatever you want to call it, in Politico today, where he buys into this whole deep state thing?
Yes.
Paranoia at times 100 or what?
Oh, no. That's too few digits. That was up to 1,000.
It was unbelievable.
The paranoia. It goes to 11.
I felt dumber after having read that. That was completely
this
nuts.
This guy out-Trumped Trump in the paranoia. He actually did this. I don't know whether you caught this, DJ. He actually compared Donald Trump to Joseph Welch from the McCarthy hearings.
I know, I did see that.
Can you believe he actually suggested that Trump might say something to the effect of, have you no decency?
Yeah, Trump has no decency, so.
As if Trump, well, that's true. He does not have any. But no, there were two things that caught me about that column. One was what he said in the first paragraph about Alexander Downer, the Australian diplomat, supposedly giving Hillary Clinton's foundation $25 million. Which was not actually what
happened. Australian diplomats get paid that much?
Downer was... no, they don't. Downer was it was actually money put in the Australian government's budget, and Downer was, in his role as foreign minister, he was acting on the government's behalf in signing the agreement that said, here is Australian government giving you, the Clinton Foundation, this money. The other part was the part at the end where it talked about who he was, and it said that Mark Penn is the new head of Harris Poll, which makes me think that the Harris Polling Organization, and I may very well be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Harris Polling Organization suddenly found a very high-ranking and deep-pocketed Republican client, because that would explain Colin.
It sure would. Mm-hmm. It sure would. Wow. And all of a sudden, in the Harris poll, Trump will be at 51, 52, 54%.
Yeah, something like that.
98, 99%. It goes to 11, guys.
I know that everybody here knows this.
The biggest percentage.
I hope the audience realizes that the Harris poll used to be a giant thing like the Gallup poll and hasn't really been around for the last 10 years. Or if it has, it's been one of the lesser polls out there.
Yeah.
So I guess they're trying to build it up again.
Yeah.
By hiring this guy.
That's
right. Anyway,
possible.
So what else has Trump been up to this week? Oh, Roger Stone was in the news. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, what was that? He says he's prepared to be indicted on, it was like on ancillary
extraneous crimes
or something like that.
Extraneous crimes.
Extraneous.
And I'm sitting here thinking, wait, so these guys are knowingly committing crimes.
But they're extraneous crimes,
yeah,
so it's okay.
I definitely did a thing that I could be indicted for. I'm like, I'm 44 years old. I have never done a thing that I could be indicted for. Like, you have to work at committing indictable crimes.
There is no such thing as an extraneous crime. Either something is criminal or it's not.
Yeah, I don't
I might be indicted. Like, really?
Well, I knew all along he was going to be indicted. You know why? Because they never called him to testify. Roger Stone was the person who was in touch with Guccifer II and was in touch with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and was the one who predicted that the John Podesta emails were going to be released. The fact that they never called him to testify was 15 glaring red flares that he was going to be indicted.
You make a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I believe that all roads through this, if there is a crime, if there is some conspiracy of collusion, all roads lead through Roger Stone. And I've said this on this podcast before, and I will keep saying it until this actually breaks in the mainstream media. The reason Donald Trump supposedly fired Roger Stone at the very beginning of his campaign, these are two guys who go back 30 years and are the closest of friends. And then they made a big stink in the media about, did Roger Stone get fired or did he quit? The reason they did all that was to have plausible deniability that Stone was not working for the Trump campaign so he could go do the dirty tricks that he is famous for. And there's no doubt in my mind that Trump told him that their deal was, Roger, I'm cutting you loose. We're going to make a big deal out of it so everyone in the world knows that you're not working for me anymore. And then you could go do your thing and I can, you know, publicly wash my hands of it.
Yeah, well, I think after Lewandowski got fired and yet he wouldn't say a single thing critical about Donald Trump, it should have become clear at that point to the mainstream media that getting fired by Donald Trump is not necessarily getting fired.
No, that's how he sends you out to be his spokesperson. Yeah. And the fact that CNN picked him up was one of the most egregious errors of journalistic ethics that I can imagine. That they took this guy who was the campaign manager and turned him into an objective column or whatever.
I don't think he was there to be objective. I think he was there because they couldn't find a whole lot of Trump defenders. And so when he put himself forward, they said, okay, let's get him.
There were plenty of Trump defenders. They just went to him, and that was ridiculous.
What's going on, and maybe I'm stealing Kevin's here, is this all supposed to be over by September 1st?
Well, depends who you ask. If you ask Rudy Giuliani, it'll be over by September 1st. If you ask Robert Mueller, he says no comment. No.
Well, there was a Reuters article today that had an unnamed source who said, that's crazy. Giuliani absolutely just made that up. Robert Mueller did not say that. Robert Mueller is not going to finish his investigation until he has crossed every T and dotted every I. And my sense was that unnamed source was inside the Mueller investigation.
So Giuliani just makes shit up now.
Yes, he does.
He's just the most dangerous person to the Trump campaign.
No, he's not even Mueller. This is their game.
The most dangerous plan. Yeah.
You know, it is to spew enough nonsense out there so that nobody knows what to believe. That is the strategy. It is.
Well, I think the first rule is don't believe Rudy Giuliani.
No, he makes shit up.
Like, yeah, you can just dismiss anything he says. Like that headline came out in Mueller investigation to be wrapped by September 2nd. Says Rudy Giuliani. I'm like, oh, you needed to reverse those clauses. You buried the lead. Put Giuliani first so we all know to stop reading.
Yeah.
And by the way, the other reason that you know that it was BS was because he claimed that Mueller told him this in a meeting over 2 weeks ago, and yet he just came public with it like the last 48 hours. Why would he hold that back if it came out 2 weeks ago?
Because he hadn't thought of it two weeks ago.
Yeah,
So let me ask you guys a question. Why would Giuliani, the nation's mayor, mayor, I mean, a man who at one point had a approval rating higher than, I don't know, Bacon, all of a sudden would destroy all his goodwill, whatever he had left, okay? For this. I mean, is it money? I mean, the guy I know likes to marry cousins.
Greg,
I mean, is Trump going to, like...
His goodwill was gone 4 years ago. What are you talking about? He hasn't been America's mayor since 2012.
I know, but he's destroying whatever his reputation...
He had no reputation.
That
reputation went up in smoke when he ran for president.
Kevin is right. When Giuliani... Giuliani bet his reputation in 2008 that it would get him to the White House.
Thank you, 2008. I said 2012, and I stand corrected.
No trouble. No worry. But he has struggled to be relevant ever since. And this is how he's decided to do it. In his mind, he is going to be the man who saves Donald Trump from this prosecution. And
wait. He thinks he's actually helping?
Yes, he does. And Trump thinks he's helping too.
Well, this is all, you know, that New York you know, good old boy network. I mean, these guys have been friends for years and years. Giuliani and Trump probably know where each other's bodies are buried. They certainly know where each other's hairlines actually begin and end.
Oh, and that's a scary thought.
So they're going to stand up for each other.
And that's very true. Yeah. In Donald Trump's mind, Rudy Giuliani saved New York City. Oddly enough, Donald Trump may have a point there. But they go back 25, 30 years. And...
yeah, I mean, don't you remember that weird video of Giuliani and drag and Trump pretending to hit on him?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Yeah.
And motorboating his fake breasts.
Same, yes.
So, listen, there's other topics in the news that we want to get to, and one, unfortunately, that we have to touch on is the Texas high school shooting this past week.
Right.
No assault weapons were involved this time, just a shotgun and a handgun.
Yes, and I want to apologize to the listeners and to three of my fellow podcasters, because I was the one who insisted that we talk about this a little more than just in painful passing, because I think this one started... a new chapter, and a very dangerous one, because not only was there the fact that this fellow used, you know, he used a shotgun and a handgun, but he also brought several bombs to school with him, and we know that either some of the bombs he brought to school or some of the bombs he left at home were actually functional, that they were working. That was a new report that came out over 24 hours. This is now beginning to shift from bringing guns to school to bringing bombs to school, and this hit me personally because my son had a lockdown exercise recently because someone had phoned in a threat. And the threat was not about bringing a gun to school. The threat was about bringing a bomb to school. I fear that we are going to start moving up from school shootings to school bombings. And we need to take this a lot more seriously than we have now. We need to look at the patterns of the people who are doing this, and some of the patterns are pretty obvious, and then we need to build on that. These are nearly all white boys or white young men. Most, if not all of them, have spouted out white supremacist rhetoric or been involved with white supremacist groups in some way or form. This is a rolling white supremacist terrorism problem. And we need to treat it as seriously as we have, quote, radical Islamic terrorism, unquote, which is a combination of Wahhabism and Ba'athism and everything else. We need to take a hard look at the white supremacist groups we have in this country and see how or if they are aiding these killers, either through just inspirational rhetoric, I use that term darkly, or actual perhaps funding and support in some way, shape, or form. We need to see if there are foreign governments involved, in particular the one foreign government that has espoused white supremacy more than any other, and that is Vladimir Putin's government in Russia. We need to be serious about this. We need to be a lot more serious than we are right now. And that doesn't mean avoiding the gun debate, and it doesn't mean focusing only on the gun debate. It means taking a broad perspective and saying, look, these are the people who are doing this. We need to figure out, you know, who benefits from this. It's obvious. And let's see if they're doing more than just benefiting passively. Let's see if they're actively helping this stuff happen and see how we can put a stop to it. We're not doing that right now, and we should.
Well, and one other thing, I want to add something to DJ. DJ, you're absolutely right. Before white supremacy, there's often misogyny. I heard a journalist who embedded herself in a number of white supremacist groups and was talking to members of these groups to report on them. And I wish I could remember her name. But she said that often the gateway is misogyny. These are men who've been rejected by the women they want to go out with. These are men who have some sort of grudge against their ex-girlfriends, their ex-wives. And it escalates from there. The first sign of that something is wrong is a man who can become abusive to women. In many cases, that's the canary in the coal mine. And so we need to start looking at men who are abusive to women, whether it's verbal trolling on the internet or actually physically abusing their partner, and thinking to ourselves, where does this go from here? Because it doesn't always stop. And in this case of this young man, the first person he killed, or one of the first people he killed, was the girl who rejected him.
Yes. You know, I want to build on that thought because, again, I agree with both of you. When I was reading about this shooter, and we're not going to mention his name on this podcast, but when I was reading about him this week, you know, one link leads to another, and I found myself reading about Elliot Rodger, who I'm sure you guys remember, was the 22-year-old man, and I shouldn't have mentioned his name, who killed six people in Santa Barbara in 2014, also because he felt rejected by women in his world. And I started watching some of the videos that he had posted that are well-known on the internet and reading his manifesto. And as horrific a human being as he was, and as awful as his crimes were, I couldn't help but have some sympathy for the person he was before he committed these crimes. And, you know, I'll share with you guys that I was not always the lady winner. I won't use the other term that I think would be inappropriate in this conversation. But I was not always the love of the ladies that I am today.
You were not Don Juan to wherever you're from.
Yeah, I was not Don Juan, and I was not Don Juan DeMarco. But yeah. but in my 20s and the earlier part of my 30s, I struggled to find female companionship. And I can empathize with a lot of what these young men are going through. Thank God I didn't make any of the choices that they made. And I guess a lot of that has to do with mental health. You know, we know there's a mental health problem in this country. But I just wonder whether there's something more we could be doing to not identify these people to stop them from killing people, but identify them to help them socialize. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, we could do that. But one of the things we need to think about is there are women who go through phases where they can't find companionship, where they are extremely lonely, and women aren't snapping, and they aren't taking out, you know, large swaths
of
people.
Let's not make this about a war between the sexes.
No, I'm not making about a war between the sexes. I'm talking about what's different is that women are not taught that they are entitled to companionship, whereas men are.
I have to take you up there. What? I'm sorry, Rebecca. I'm going to call you on that. I'm going to call shenanigans. This idea, and I know it comes out of the incel conversation that everybody's been having for the last month, this idea that there is a broad portion of men that feel entitled to women's sexuality, I disagree with. There is a handful of men who are speaking about this, and frankly, I think that it's just one or two people who created this idea, and then a lot of men, because people do nutsy things on social media to begin with, a lot of people are jumping on that bandwagon. There aren't men walking around that feel entitled to women.
Historically speaking, marriage was a chattel exchange of ownership from father to husband.
Yeah, but let's talk about the last 25 years. We're not talking about historically speaking. There aren't men who walk around thinking she should be doing me. There are men walking around thinking, I wish she would do me.
Why can't I
get her? DJ, let me finish, please.
Okay.
You are doing a disservice to the conversation. I'm telling you, you are doing a disservice to the conversation to make this about men feeling entitled. You're missing the broader context. It's not about entitlement. It's about loneliness and not knowing how to socialize.
But when you mentioned that reporter, I started doing some digging. I think it was L. Reeve with Vice.
Yes, sounds right.
And it was actually one of the things that she talked about, and one of the things that fuel these groups is that essentially these men think that they should be entitled, that they do think they should be entitled to sex with white women.
Who are these men? It's a handful of men who write stupid things on the internet.
It's a handful of men that are killing children all over the country, and not just children. Dylan Roof shot up a church in South Carolina. It's a handful of men that are killing a lot of people, and we need to ask ourselves, why are these handful of men thinking this way? And part of it...
That's what I'm saying.
And part of that is the sense that they think they are entitled to sex with the women that they are pursuing. I mean, I was an awkward teenager myself. But even I recognized at the time, when I realized that after trying to screw up my courage to ask a girl out for 2 months, I had spent so much time walking 50 feet behind her while I screwed up my courage that everybody thought I was a stalker. I was like, okay, oh, you know what? I got to get the rejection over with and move on with my life. And that's exactly what I did. But the fact of the matter is, There may only be a handful of men that feel the sense of entitlement, but they all seem to be white supremacists, and I want to know if they all know the same white supremacists, if they all are tied in with the same organizations, and if the organizations with which they are tied into happen to get support from Russia. We need to look at the bigger picture. We need to investigate what the hell is going on, and right now we aren't doing it.
The More Perfect Union, real debate without the hate, now heard on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio.
Anyways, moving on to other topics. Well, you know, going back actually to male chauvinism and the patriarchal society that we do live in, we have to look at what's happening on the abortion front and the abortion restrictions front the last couple of weeks. Rebecca, you made an observation about what's happening.
Yeah, no, it's an executive order. It's a rule he's trying to promulgate through HHS, where he wants to restrict Title X family planning funding to organizations that do not perform or refer abortions. So basically, if you say the word abortion, or if abortions happen in the same building as your clinic that provides other services, you could lose your Title X funding. And as we all know, Title X funding does not go to abortion. Currently, we have something called the Hyde. All these old white senators look the same to me.
The Hyde Amendment.
You know, that says that no federal dollars may pay for abortions. So, and this is basically a domestic form of what we've called the global gag rule or the Mexico City rule, where you can't get foreign aid entities that refer for abortions can't get U.S. funding. And it dates back to Reagan. It's not a new idea, but it feels very Pence-ian. And his whole notion of, you know, restricting access to abortion being one of his foremost concerns. And it's no offense, TJ, it's bad supply side thinking. Like, if people don't know there's abortions, people won't want them. And that's not actually the reason people get abortions. It's not like we get pregnant and start thinking, well, I could get pickles and ice cream, or I could get an abortion. That's not what it's about.
I think the point that you're making, and I agree with it, is that when you make abortions more expensive, you don't cut down on abortions. You cut down on safe abortions.
That's always the case. You can look at the statistics the world over. If you go to the Guttmacher Institute website, you will see that the abortion rate remains constant regardless of legality.
So if your goal is to have more young mothers bleed to death, then yes, the Trump and Pence idea is solid.
But it's 2018, and you don't necessarily have to bleed to death. You could just poison yourself with whatever imitation mifepristone you order off the internet.
In any event, the incentives are all wrong. I actually wrote about this in a very detailed column for the More Perfect Union podcast website, I guess it's about 2 or 3 weeks ago now, where I talked about the whole purpose behind laws are to change incentives. And we don't really talk about incentives beyond the law on this issue, which is a horrible mistake. We don't talk about the financial incentives, as Rebecca tried to mention. We don't talk about the fact, and this is especially among pro-lifers, and I still consider myself one, that we don't say, look, when we infringe on someone else's rights in any other circumstance, the governments compensate them for it. I mean, you can't put an easement through somebody's farmland without them being compensated. And yet, we're essentially declaring eminent domain on a uterus with no compensation? It's insane. There should be compensation for prenatal expenses, for postnatal expenses, for lost wages due to pregnancy and early child rearing, and for lost income due to changes in career tracks, if any. I mean, you know, give the patriarchy a price tag and turn the bond vigilantes into feminism shock troops. That's what we can do, and we can do it in a way that actually changes the incentive so that women choose to save lives and save children. I don't think this will matter really worth the beans, in part because it can probably be overturned on 14th Amendment grounds.
Well, someone will file a lawsuit and put an injunction so that it'll have to undergo judicial review. But again, right, because it's not a new concept, it does have some potential for being. I mean, in terms of judicial review and what the outcomes could be, I'm more concerned because this is an executive order. It's a rule. It can be changed in the next administration. But what concerns me more is actually the Iowa law that outlaws abortion after a heartbeat can be heard, which is, you know, almost instantaneously. There's a heartbeat within the first few weeks of gestation. And that is going to undergo judicial review and it could potentially go to the Supreme Court. And yeah, Mitch McConnell cheated and got his guy on the Supreme Court. So we could see some changes to Roe.
Okay. And
well, hang on. You've got, now I'm going to dissect the Supreme Court.
No, don't, please.
No, the balance of the court is the same as it was before Scalia died. So,
okay, fine. I'll just keep it brief. Anthony Kennedy has made it abundantly clear he does not accept any abortion restriction that's earlier than the point of fetal viability. He made that clear in Casey versus Planned Parenthood. I don't see him changing his mind.
No, which leads me to my last question. I know that we're about 3 weeks or 4 weeks too soon on this one, but I'm going to ask for a prediction anyways. I'm going to go around the table, starting with DJ. Does Anthony Kennedy retire this summer?
No.
No. No.
No, 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 no.
He's hired clerks for the next term.
Four of them.
Yeah.
Which is something that you generally would not do.
You don't hire a clerk that you don't actually intend to employ.
Although one did, and I'm not sure whether it was Stevens. Stevens actually hired clerks and then quit. But generally speaking, you wouldn't
do that. No, he wouldn't do that to him.
Gosh, I just hope that we're all right on this one. I'm a little nervous that DJ predicted no. So,
yeah, stop that, DJ. Say yes. Turn it around.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everybody for listening, and I'm sure you all want to do that too. Please follow us on Twitter at hashtag MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us and enjoy us as well. And if you'd like to debate with us between podcasts, I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of the people that join Open Fire Politics mention the podcast as how they found out about the group. Did you guys know that?
No.
Did you guys care?
No, I did not.
I care deeply.
I do.
It matters to me
and
a lot.
I think also people in Open Fire find our podcast, so I think it's a nice little circle that we close. But we want people from all over the world to find us, not just those small subsamples of the universe. And so, with that in mind, we want everyone to have a wonderful week. Any last thoughts?
I had no idea we were so popular with the Russian bot community.